The morning of today's daf, Baba Basra's Kufayin Hey. We are starting today on Kufayin Dalad. We are just about to turn the page on Kufayin Dalad. We're on the very bottom of the Amud Aleph. We're going to go to the Amud Beis. We're talking about Arev today. Today we're going to be talking about Shibudim. Last two dapim of Baba Basra is packed with some very basic information regarding money and how to understand loans and the mechanics of being a guarantor and that of putting a lien on property. As I mentioned already, the end of Baba Basra does not end with. Actually, there will be a tail end of Agadah at the very end of the Mishnah, but generally speaking, some of the most basic issues are coming up here at the end of the Perek and subsequently. The end of the Masechta. We're on the very bottom of Kufayin Dalet Amud Aleph, and we're discussing now Arevos. We're talking about a guarantor. Yesterday, we introduced ourselves to the idea that when it comes to the guarantor, there are really two levels of being a guarantor. There's an Arev and there's a Kablan. An Arev is a regular, is a basic guarantor, and a Kablan is just a shade more intense as being a guarantor. Practically speaking, what the difference would be, although we saw it was a debate between the Tanakhama and Rav Shimon Gamliel, but the Gemara says we don't follow like Rav Shimon Gamliel, we follow like the Tanakhama, and that means as follows. When you're an Arev, so you are second in line. Meaning first you go after the primary borrower. The borrower is exhausted of all of its resources. So then and only then do you go to the Arev. When it comes to the Kablan, since you accepted this higher level of guarantorship, so therefore you are going to be not second in line, but you're going to be basically competing for being first in line. Meaning that if the lender wants to go to the guarantor, to the principal borrower, he may do so. And if he wants to go to you, he may do so as well. That's the benefit. I put that in quotes, the benefit of being a Kablan, a high-level guarantor. What exactly is the language in order to become a Kablan as opposed to guarantor? So we discussed it yesterday. So go over yesterday's daf for a review of that. And the Gemara now is going to continue discussing more about this idea of being a guarantor. So on Kufayin Dalet Amud Aleph, we're going to start today like about five lines from the bottom of the Amud with the words Hawa Rava. There was a guarantor. This case is a little bit complicated, but it goes like basically as follows. Hawa Rava Diasme Depar Lamava Mikame De Lodinu Liasme. So there was a guarantor, and he ends up becoming a guarantor for an estate, which means that really the story starts with the father, where the father borrowed money, and the father wanted a co-signer before he borrowed the money, so he turned to a guy, a good friend of his, and he says, look, I need you to co-sign on the loan with me. Would you do so? And the guy says, sure, no problem at all. Okay, so we have now the father and his co-signer on this loan, and then the father dies. So now the co-signer is still a co-signer on the loan. It's still the same obligation, just the obligation now moves down to the children. Now the estate has the obligation, and he's still co-signing on the loan. Then he goes over to the lender and the co-signer, that is, and the co-signer pays back the lender the loan. Now the co-signer is now hoping and expecting that the estate is going to pay him back. And why not? In other words, he's the one who laid out the money in order to pay back the loan, and he did so without informing the estate, so he figured that the estate is going to pay him back. As we pointed out yesterday, really changes the entire nature of the loan. Meaning when the estate owed the money to the lender, so that's a milva b'shtar. That was a documented loan. Meaning when dad borrowed the money, it was documented. So now the documentation still exists, the note holder is still holding the note, so therefore the estate is bound by a milva b'shtar. However, once the cosigner pays back the loan, and once the estate now owes the cosigner the money, that's not a milva bishtar, that's a milva alpeh. That's now an oral obligation. And as we're going to say, we're going to see again a couple times in today's daf, so the estate is not bound legally to have to pay oral obligations. Now, there's a mitzvah to do so, it's only the right thing to pay off the oral obligations, but it's not a, there's no encumbrance, there's no lien on the property in order to pay off those obligations. That's the basic storyline of what's going on over here. Let's read it inside. Again, Amavis Chaveh Ayde Arev, sorry. Hahu Arava, there is a guarantor, the Yasme, of an estate, the Parlamava. So he, the co-signer, paid off the lender, Mikame de Lodin Liasme, before notifying the orphans. So he did it on his own. So Amar Rav Papa Prias Bachov Mitzvah. Now Rav Papa says, now as far as the estate is concerned, their obligation to pay the guarantor, that's a mitzvah, meaning it's still an obligation to pay, but it's a mitzvah, meaning it's only a mitzvah. It's not an absolute obligation. V'yasme l'abnei mitzvah ma'avin, ninu. And at this point in time, the children of the estate are extraordinarily young, meaning they're not b'nei mitzvah. They're not yet at the age where they're expected, they are required to do mitzvos, and so therefore they don't have to pay. So Rav Papa's ruling on this issue is that at this point in time, there is simply no obligation for the children to pay the guarantor the money that they once owed the lender, but now they owe the guarantor. Fine. The Gemara goes on, Rav Huna b'Rei d'Rav Yeshua Amar, Rav Huna b'Rei d'Rav Yeshua actually agrees in practice, but for a different reason. Meaning his position is going to be is that not only is there no requirement legally for the children to pay the guarantor, there actually is no requirement whatsoever for the children to pay the guarantor. Why should that be? Because of the following concern. Meaning their father died. They don't know what happened regarding their father and the lender. They don't know. And it's possible, meaning we don't know this to be so, but it's within the realm of possibility that what Dad did before he died is he called the lender over and he said, look, I know I owe you money, and I don't know if I'm going to make it right now, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you some coins. I'm going to give you a bag of coins. And what you'll do is you'll basically hold it against as collateral against the loan. And in the event that you need it, you just simply keep it. So it's possible that that happened, and we don't know that that's the case. Now, let's...
So the lender is a crook.
The lender is a crook. Let's not label everyone right now. But here's what we are going to say. What we are going to say is as follows: that if there was only the lender and the estate after the death of the father, so then what would the lender do? Remember, he's holding an oath. So what he would do is he would make a shvua. He would make an oath that none of the loan has been paid, and then he would collect from the kids. Now, if there was a bag of coins given to him, and he did keep it. So then, of course, I agree with you. So and the label's right on the money. He's a crook. We're not saying he's a crook. We're simply saying that this is a real possibility. So now, if the lender himself was collecting from the estate, he'd make a shvua, and then if he made a shvua, so then we would take it. But here, however, what happened was is that the estate's no longer dealing with the lender. The guarantor paid off the lender. Now it's the kids who need to pay off the guarantor. But now, because of this possibility that maybe the dad already paid off the loan, so now the kids, according to Rav Huna, are totally off the hook and do not have to pay the guarantor anything. And again, remember, the guarantor is not a note holder. They owe him money, but only because of the lender, but the lender no longer is in the picture. And again, we're not 100% sure that they even need to pay the lender back. The lender would have made a shvua. The guarantor is certainly not in a position to make a shvua. So therefore, according to Rav Huna, same conclusion as Rav Papa, but for a different reason, and that is, we're afraid that Dad already paid back the loan. So, yeah.
Okay, well, stay tuned.
Your suggestion is excellent. We'll stay tuned. So my benayu, we get my answer. So the Gemara now points out, kufayin dal amud beis, top of the amud. So the Gemara points out that there's going to be a real practical difference between the way Rav Papa's saying and Rav Huna's saying it. Again, the case is where the lender's holding a note against the orphans. The orphans have a guarantor on the loan. The guarantor paid off the lender. Now the guarantor is coming after the kids for compensation. So, according to Rav Papa and according to Rav Huna, they don't have to pay the guarantor, but really for two different reasons. According to Rav Papa, because they're labnei mitzvah, and according to Rav Huna, for fear that the loan was paid off. The Gemara now points out there's going to be a practical difference. For example, Gemara gives two examples, but it's really speaking to the very same idea. Let's say, for example, right before Dad died, Dad said, I did not pay back the loan, period. Meaning, in other words, he's putting together, he's organizing all of his affairs and his entire estate, and he's telling the kids, I have an outstanding loan against so-and-so, and I did not pay it back. So under those circumstances, now we know that there's no way that he paid it back. He admitted he didn't pay it back. So according to Rav Papa, still the children are allowed b'nei mitzvah, but according to Rav Huna, there's no longer concern that the loan was not paid back. Inami, the Gemara gives another suggestion, which is basically the same idea, d'shamtu u'meis b'shamte, where Dad was defaulting on the payment, on the loan, and it's now been a long time, he's been a long time in default. The lender went to the court and basically said, look, the guy is shirking his responsibility, and the court now put an excommunication, a cherem, on the father, on the borrower, and he died while in excommunication, that is a clear indication that in no way, shape, or form he paid back the loan. Again, it comes out to the same point. According to Rav Papa, it's not relevant to our discussion. And according to Rav Papa, the reason why the kids don't have to pay back the guarantor is because they're lav b'nei mitzvah. And according to Rav Huna, they would have to pay back because, again, it comes down to the concern of maybe the father paid back, but because he died in excommunication, we know he didn't pay back. Hilchasa k'Rav Huna b'Rei Rav Yehoshua. The Gemara says, and as far as with the conclusion is concerned, we are going to side with Rav Huna b'Rei Rav Yehoshua, meaning that there is this genuine concern that maybe the father paid back the loan, and so therefore, if the lender's holding the note, so he'll make a shvu and collect. If the lender's no longer responsible, if the lender's no longer holding the note, meaning the guarantor paid it back, so then the kids don't have to pay back the guarantor.
The very fact that the Malibu swore and he put the money from the owner, that that's enough of an indication that he wasn't getting, that he didn't get paid.
Right, that's if that's...
assume that he was a crook.
Right, that's if he makes a shua, I agree. Right. But in this case over here, the Arif paid back the Malva without first consulting with the kids.
Right.
What the Arif should have done is the Arif should have said to the kids, you sure he owes you the money? You know, but in other words, the Arev paid back first. Now the only obligation the kids have is to the Arev, and according to Rav Huna, they don't have to pay them. Okay. Meitzvei, the Gemara challenges based on the following braisa, Arev shayeshtar chov yotze mitachas yado. Eino gove. Okay, now, Ben made the suggestion just a moment ago. The Gemara now deals with it. The braisa deals with it. And that is, let's say the Arev is holding the note. Guarantor is holding the note. Meaning he's guaranteeing the loan, he's co-signed on the loan, and then... the principal borrower died, and now he paid back the loan, but he took the note, and he was in with the expectation of getting paid back from the estate. So, if he's just holding the note, so in a gova, so he's not collecting. Just because he's holding the note doesn't mean he's a note holder.
Why not?
What's your here? Right. So, okay, good. So, just because he's holding the note does not make him the note holder. Why? So, because we really don't know at this point in time whether or not the note was actually transferred to him, or maybe the lender dropped the note, maybe the lender gave it to him as a pikadon, but we don't know. However, and then the braisa says, however, if there's a note on the note, and the note says paid, so now you know that the note was paid, it was signed off by the lender, and so therefore, now the guarantor can use his note in order to collect from the estate. Now, so now, how does this work? So according to Rav Huna, you totally understand how it works. Because remember, Rav Huna says the only reason why the guarantor is not going to get paid is because there was a fear, there was a concern that maybe the principal borrower already paid back the lender. Now, we know that's not the case. How do we know that that's not the case? Because in a scenario where before dad dies, he says to his kids, I did not pay back the loan, so now we know that the loan's in existence and in full force. And now that the paper was transferred over from the lender to the guarantor, because the guarantor paid off the loan, so now the guarantor has the right to collect using this note. So we understand the entire braisa according to Rav Huna. El Rav Papa Kashu, but according to Rav Papa, whether or not the loan is due or not due is irrelevant. According to Rav Papa, remember the issue is that once it's no longer a written loan, once it's an oral loan, the kids simply don't have an obligation to pay. So the Gemara says, so according to Rav Papa, how do you understand the braisa? But the Gemara says, what do you mean, according to Rav Papa? I do understand the braisa. Shani hasam lahachitarch v'kasavle iskabalti. What do you mean? The children don't have to pay only because it's an oral loan. Here it's not an oral loan. It's a written loan. And remember, now the paper was transferred from the lender to the guarantor. And the guarantor now has documentation that he's owed the money. So it's not a milvah apet, it's a milvah bishtar. That's why, according to Rav Papa, the guarantor is going to get paid in such a scenario. Okay, next case in the Gemara. How are Rav Dovi Kochavim? Depar Leovi Kochavim. So here now, again, we have a guarantor, and the lender in this particular case is a non-Jew. And again now, the storyline is going to be the same storyline as it was previously. The only change in this story between this case and the previous case is that the lender is a non-Jew. Why should that make a difference? So stay tuned as you'll see. So again, dad borrowed money from the non-Jew. Dad died. The estate now has the obligation to pay. There was a co-signer. The co-signer paid back the loan with the expectation that the estate is going to pay him back. And now, so even if, generally speaking, you are concerned that maybe dad paid back the loan, and maybe we didn't know about it, Like we said, like Rav Huna said earlier, Hani Mili Yisrael Aval VeKocham Kevin DeBasa Rava Azalo Cheshin Letzarei. So he says that's true if the lender's a Jew, but not true if a lender's a non-Jew. Why? Remember, we said this yesterday. We said that when it comes to non-Jew, if there's a guarantor in the picture, the non-Jew in their civil law. Now, the Gemara attributed this to the Persians, but I'm guessing that it was slightly more universal. But in their civil law, when there's a guarantor, so they're totally comfortable going straight after the guarantor and not necessarily the borrower. That's how they view guarantorship. They view it as an either or. So the Gemara says that when a person signs off of being a guarantor of a loan, and the lender's a non-Jew, so the Gemara says under those circumstances, since he knows that he's going to be come after first, so therefore we're not worried about sorry, we're not worried about maybe the principal borrower paid off the loan already and nobody knew about it. So Amalei Adarabba Filaman Damalo Cheshin Letzarei Hani Mili Yisrael Avol VeKochavim Kevin De Dainina Basarava Azli Lav Dat Vesin Tzarari Mikara Lava Mekabalei. To which the Gemara says, I don't understand. If the psychology of the lender being a non-Jew is that he's going straight after the guarantor, so the Gemara says, I can now make a compelling argument in the other direction, which is, you got a phone call from a friend. He's borrowing money from a non-Jew, and he calls you up to be the guarantor. So you think to yourself now as follows. Wait one second. The lender's going to be a non-Jew, and you're asking me to be a guarantor. Now, I know that means what? That basically I'm just going to be painting a target right on my back. A big target on my back, because I know that in their civil law, they go after the guarantor before they go after the principal borrower. Wow, so you're basically asking me to stand in front of you in the line of fire. Thank you so much. I like that. I really appreciate the phone call. I'll tell you what, call me again tomorrow. Or better yet, call me next week. Or even better yet, you'll lose my number. So in other words, so the Gemara says really the psychology now is that if you're asked to be a guarantor where the lender's a non-Jew, so the truth of the matter is that you're not going to be interested and you're not going to be excited about the whole prospect. Which then the Gemara now says is makes it more compelling argument to think that the only way you were coaxed into it is if the borrower says, oh, don't worry, I already gave him collateral against the loan. Okay, now you're going to be somewhat more assuaged. I don't know if you're still going to give in to this, but you're going to be somewhat more assuaged. So now what the Gemara is really arguing is, if the lender's a non-Jew, there's actually more compelling argument to make that the borrower actually gave some piece of collateral over, because why in the world would you agree to, you know, what probably is going to be a loss of money for you. So the Gemara says, so really, if the lender's a non-Jew, I can make even a stronger argument to this idea of tsrari, that maybe the lender, unbeknownst to the general population, gave some sort of collateral against the loan, and that will therefore make even a bigger question of whether or not, I'm sorry, the borrower gave collateral against the loan, which will then present even a bigger question of maybe the loan was already paid up. Wait, just one second, one at a time. Who gets which property?
The whole loan was based on property, going off against the property, she was in the property, and the Kavlan pays it off.
Right.
So she gets the property after everybody has to pay off the kids,
and he pays off
everybody?
Right, is he going to, in other words, no, because now from his perspective, it's not a contracted loan, it's only an oral debt, and so therefore there's not going to be any lien against the property. He'll just simply have the estate will have a debt to him, but unencumbered. Okay, fine. Right. Okay, I'm not sure about that, but generally speaking, though, if there was no contract and the guarantor just paid off the loan, so then it would be an unencumbered debt. Yeah.
If the lender is getting collateral, why would he need the guarantor also?
Nothing. In other words, you want recourse. You want full recourse on your loan, and if there are multiple sources of recourse, you'll take it. You of course, the lender wants to know that he's going to get paid back. Let's continue on the Gemara. Okay, this was a line of the Mishnah. Let's just review this point of the Mishnah. The Mishnah taught us the following: if you have a husband who's divorcing his wife, we have to be suspicious of the following. He's not really interested in divorcing his wife. What he's really interested in doing is basically her collecting the ksuva. in a situation where someone co-signed on the ksuva, he was getting married at the time and he felt like totally unprepared financially to get married, and so therefore somebody's going to he goes to somebody to co-sign on the ksuva, and so years later, we're worried that really the divorce is just a collusion. And what he's interested in doing is having now, in other words, when it comes to the payment to the ksuva, he'll say to his newly divorced wife, his ex-wife, look, I'm really sorry. Obviously, I owe you the ksuva. I don't have the money to pay. Let's go to the co-signer. Co-signer now is going to pay the ksuva. And now they got remarried, and now they have the payment. We're worried about collusion. The Mishnah says, in the name of Shimon ben Gamliel, so here's what you're going to have to do in order to avoid such collusion. When a man is getting a divorce, and there's a co-signer on the ksuva, so he has to make a neder that he's never going to get hana from this woman ever again, and that will prevent him from remarrying her, which will prevent the entire scheme from happening. This was not arranged before the marriage. This is just simply done at the time of the divorce. Meaning, who's ever presiding over the divorce? We're going to assume a Beis Din is presiding over the divorce, and they know that they're looking at the ksuva, and they see there's a cosigner on the ksuva. They're going to say, okay, you want to get divorced? That's fine, but you have to make a neder. Okay. Now, Moshe Baratzi, this is still back to yesterday's daf. Oh, this is such a good story. It's a highlight of the 10th parak. Moshe Bar Atzri, Arav Deksuvasa Dekalte Have. Moshe Bar Atzri was a guarantor of none other than his son's ksuva. Now, I know it's very strange, but again, you know families well enough, you know family dynamics, and it's possible the father's wealthy and the kid's not wealthy. And why dad want to share some of the wealth with the son? In this particular case, the answer seems to be no. Dad was not interested in sharing any of his wealth with his son. So Moshe was wanting to get married. Sorry. The son of Moshe, which happens to be, his name is Rav Huna, as we'll see in just a moment. So Rav Huna wants to get married. Problem is that he's financially not within a position to get married. Doesn't feel that way. So he turns to his father to co-sign on the ksuva, and dad says, sure, no problem at all. Okay. So Moshe bar Atzri, Arav de ksuvasa de kalte have, Rav Huna b'rei, tzor b'midrabanan hava. Now his son Rav Huna is a couple of things. Number one, he's a young Talmid Chacham. Number two, d'chiklei milsa. He was extraordinarily poor. And so now, in the beginning of their marriage, with Rav Huna and his new wife, so they're really struggling financially. And so, it goes on for some time. I don't know how long. I can embellish if I'd like to. But without giving details that I don't know about, sometime later now, he turns to Abai and he says to Abai, you know, right, this marriage is really hard. Financially, it's really hard. We don't have money. What are we going to do? So Amar Abaye. So Abaye says, well, let me suggest the following. Okay, here we go. Nezel Nasbe Eitzel Rav Huna. Maybe, right, Lake and the Nezel Nasbe Eitzel, there's no one who's going to give the following advice to Rav Huna. I mean, he asks like quizzically, like, you know, it's like a hint. It's like he's intimating. So, Rav Huna, Denigrishal Devasayu. So, what he should do is he should divorce his wife. Vitizav Tikbe Ksuvasa Meavua. That way, she'll be allowed to collect the Ksuva from her father in law. Vahadu Nehadre, and then marry her again. So, Abai says, that sounds like sound advice to me. Now, if all this does not sound like sound advice to you, you're in good shape, because the Mishnah told us you shouldn't do that. In fact, the Mishnah told us what to do in order to avoid doing this. So how can Abai give such advice? Please stay tuned. So Amalei Rava Vahani Yadrenu Hanantanan. So Rava says to Abai, it's not good advice. Look at our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that under such circumstances, if you know there's a cosign in the ksuva, the only way that you can preside over the divorce is only if the husband first makes a neder that he's not getting benefit from this woman ever again. So it's not even going to work. Forget the ethics of it, which we're going to get to in just a moment. It's simply not going to work. So Amalei Abai Atu called the Megarish Bebeidina Megarish. So Abai says, look, when you get divorced, you don't have to do so in front of a Beis Din, meaning that the person who's presiding over the divorce doesn't have to know everything. Like yesterday, I showed Rabbi Flug this Gemara. He was already more than familiar with this Gemara. And there's a Chumra, there's a stringency. There is no reference throughout anywhere in the Gemara that you have to get divorced in Beis Din. In fact, when you read our Gemara that we just read right now, it seems pretty clear from the Gemara that a divorce does not need to occur in Beis Din. What do you need for a divorce? You need a document. You need two witnesses. That's really all you need. We have a chumrah. When I say we, I mean the Jewish people. I mean this has been going on for hundreds of years. We have a chumrah that a divorce has to occur in Beis Din, right? Anytime nowadays there's a divorce taking place, so a Beis Din is put together. A panel of three is put together for a divorce. This chumrah goes back to the Noda Bihuda. Rabbi Cheska Landa was really the originator of such a chumrah, and the Jewish people have adopted this chumrah. Now Rabbi Cheska Landa knew this gemara as well, and so I was back and forth with Rabbi Flug yesterday in terms of what did Rabbi Cheska Landa do about this particular gemara. This gemara seems very clear. You don't have to get divorced in a Beis Din. Okay, anyway. I understand. There's more to discuss about that. I just brought it up quickly. Anyway, called the Megarish, but they didn't Megarish. So, Figlai Milsa de Kohenhu. Now, on top of everything, meaning, Abai and Rav are discussing whether or not the advice should be given. The Gemara points out that there was a practical issue, an impasse, and that was Rav Huna, and of course his father, that means as well, were Kohanim. Which means, of course, that none of this would ever work, because once he divorces his wife, he cannot marry her again. She is a grusha, and a Kohen cannot marry a grusha, even if it's his own grusha. It's still a grusha, and you can't marry her. So, to which now, Abaye realizes that the advice that he gave, and again, the ethics of it we're going to get to, but just in terms of whether it's going to work, it's not going to work. A, the Mishnah told us that a neder is required. B, in this particular case, Rav Huna was a Kohen. To which Abaye says, now I understand the adage. People say, you know where poverty is? Poverty is amongst the poor. You know, I think that's like, you know, some sort of like hokey statement that's made by the older men. But Abaye says, but it's true. In other words, I see that certain people have a certain mazel where even when there's some sort of scheme or plan to get rich, but basically certain people have a mazel to be poor. And what can I say? That's just simply how it works. Now, the Gemara is bothered by the ethics. Meaning, how can Abaye even suggest to Rav Huna, hey, I got a great idea for you. Let's do the following scheme. The Gemara says, not that long ago, we learned together in Baba Basra. It was back on Kuf Lamed Zayin in Baba Basra. Okay. It was a pretty long time ago. But anyway, but over a month ago. But we learned not that long ago that Abaye told us that if anyone gives the kind of a financial advice where it was just unethical, it was immoral, so Abaye says you're a Rasha Arum. You are a deceitful, evil person. Now, the case over there is slightly different than our case, but it speaks to the same basic idea. Case over there was, if you remember, there was a person who designated a primary beneficiary and a secondary beneficiary. Meaning the guy says to the person, I'm gifting you this estate, but after you die, then I want to gift it to so-and-so. So he designates a second beneficiary. Now, during the time where the first beneficiary had it, can he sell it? Yes. So we had a lengthy discussion, but the answer is, as Ben succinctly points out, the answer is yes, he can. He shouldn't, because it violates the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law is that the gifter wanted it to go in a certain order, to the first beneficiary and to the second beneficiary. But if someone nudges the first beneficiary and says to him, you know, you really can sell it. You really have the ability to do so. So you are considered a Rasha Arum. The Gemara says, and Abaye said that. The Gemara says over here, I imagine the same thing. Meaning, Abaye is basically telling a guy, hey, you know what? I have a way you could basically squeeze your father for his money, and it's all good. What? In other words, why would he give that kind of advice? It's unethical. So the Gemara says, Beno Shana Vitzor Mera Baran Shani. So the Gemara says, yeah, but over here, there are two mitigating considerations. One, well, you're not squeezing an outsider. You're squeezing dad to give his money to the kid, to give his kid money. Meaning that the general thinking is that really dad wants his kid to have money. He doesn't want to just outright give it to his kid, but if there's a way where somehow we can, even though it may be a slight manipulation of the law, in order to do so, but we generally assume that the father wants to take care of his kid financially. Two, another consideration, says the Gemara, is that he's a Talmid Chacham, meaning, and that people do want to help Talmid Chachamim. Supporting Talmid Chachamim goes all the way back to Zvulun Yisachar, meaning, so support of a Talmid Chacham is also something that we want to encourage. So, even though we're doing it in ways which are, generally speaking, not the most preferred ways, not the most condoned ways. Nevertheless, over here, considering that A, it's a son, and B, it's a Talmid Chacham, Gemara says that Abaye felt under these circumstances, if it could work, so then he suggested it. But of course, as we already know, it couldn't work. Okay, yes.
Yeah, Couldn't the character go against the father?
Can the
father go against the son? Does he have a case against the son like a lawyer but the orphan?
Oh, in other words, and expect repayment. Again, if the father really wanted to help his son, so then he would just simply waive the need to pay him back, perhaps.
Why would Abaye even say it, knowing that
they could? Well, meaning Abaye wasn't given all the information at first. It seems that way. In other words, the way the story presents itself, it seems like he didn't know it, and he was just like, it was almost like he was like ruminating, like, I wonder if, you know, right. So the Gemara says, okay, but wait one more second, the Gemara says, one more complication to this whole story. You know, if you're a guarantor for a ksuva, you know that really you're not a guarantor. Now, why should that be? I'm going to explain in just a moment. Right now, just let's accept that as a fact. A guarantor for a ksuva is not really financially liable. So the Gemara says, so if that's true, so over here when the father accepted to be guarantor for his son's ksuva, it doesn't have any real teeth. He's not really a guarantor. So the Gemara says, Kablan Hava. So the Gemara says that when dad took on the status of being a guarantor for his son, he took so in the, not in the lower level guarantorship, but in the higher level. He was a kablan. So the Gemara says, Hani chalamandamar kablan duksuva afagav delesa nechse laba mishtabi shapir, elamandamar iesle mishtabi delesa la mishtabi maikalamemar. So the Gemara says, even this is subject to a debate. Some are of the opinion, that only if the father has assets, his kablanus is to be taken seriously. So the Gemara says, "Ibai seima mehave havelei v'ishtadof v'ibai seima abla gabe brei shibudim meshabin nafshei." So the Gemara says one of two things. Number one, maybe it could very well be that Rav Huna did have assets at the time of marriage, and that's why when the father accepted himself to be an arev, or I should say better, a kablan, it's accepted because maybe the son did have property at the time. Why doesn't it have the son have property later on in the marriage? The Gemara says ishtadef. It was destroyed. Or the Gemara says that a father to a son, again, because the father has an affinity towards his son and really does want to help his son, so maybe there was Gemira's das, maybe such a guarantorship is in fact to be taken seriously. Itmar. Now, the Gemara made mention of this idea of being a guarantor for Ksuva, and now the Gemara is going to address it straight on. Arev de Ksuva divrei kol lemishtabe. If you're a low-level Arev for Ksuva, you never really are financially committed. Now, why not? So the Gemara is going to say it, but I'll say it in just a moment. I'll say it now. Because let's consider now. A guy wants to get married, and what he's worried about is the financial strain of, well, if we get a divorce, I can't afford a divorce. So what do I go over to the person and I say, oh, don't worry, I'll co-sign. Am I really financially committing myself? So what the Gemara is now arguing is, no, I'm really not. What I'm saying is, you need a little nudge to get married? Fine, I'll give you the nudge.
So they're attending something.
Right, that's exactly it. In other words, I'm not really financially committing myself.
You say that there wasn't an asma.
Right, remember, now, in the marriage, you're not borrowing money. She's not lending you money. The ksuva obligation is that if in the event you get a divorce, then you're going to be financially on the hook. But right now, at this point in time, she's not lending money. She wants in on the marriage. You also kind of want in on the marriage, but financially got cold feet. Okay, fine, so I'll give you the nudge. But I'm not really financially committing myself. I just know that you need the push. So an arev on a ksuva is not really financially committed. Kablan de balchov devra kol mishtabed. Now, if you are a kablan on a loan, so that's a real shibud. You're really on the hook. Kablan de ksuva varev de balchov. So what about a kablan on a ksuva and an arev on a balchov? Pligi. So interestingly enough, we have a debate. So one opinion is that if the borrower has assets at the time, so then you're committed. Because you're committed knowing that you may not be needed. But if you're needed, so then you're ready. However, but if the borrower doesn't have any assets at the time of the loan, so and you're just simply saying yes, your yes is not really a yes. You would not be saying yes to co-sign on a loan knowing full well that A, you're not getting the money, and B, you're going to have to pay for that loan? Like, no, who does that? So according to the one opinion, you're not really committing under such circumstances. And the Gemara says that no, the other opinion is that if you're a Kablan on a Ksuva, or if you're an Arev on a regular loan, you are committed. Hilchasa, and the Gemara now concludes on all this, Arev ben Yisrael ben Leislay Mishtabed, that when it comes to an Arev, whether or not the borrower does have money or does not have money, if you are signing on a, co-signing on a loan, so now you are financially committed. Bar me Arev Diksuva, the only exception being an Arev on a Ksuva, Afagav Dislel about La Mishtabed, where there an Arev on a Ksuva, regardless of whether the groom does or does not have money, you're not really financially committing yourself. And here the Gemara says it straight out. My time up, Mitzuhuda, but Velav Midi Chasre. So the Gemara makes two compelling arguments. Number one, you're promoting a mitzvah. Getting married is a mitzvah. According to the Rambam writes it very clearly, that the marriage itself is a mitzvah. Meaning, you can make the argument which the Rush makes, which is just the mitzvah per revu is a mitzvah. But, and the marriage is only a hechsher mitzvah. But the Rambam writes very clearly that getting married is a mitzvah. So you're promoting two people getting married. That's a mitzvah. So, one, you're facilitating a mitzvah. And two, says the Gemara, you're not causing a loss. Meaning, again, like I said earlier, she's not lending him money. So there's no real loss at this point in time. Yes, if they get a divorce and he's financially unable to pay, so then she's gonna be in a predicament. But right now, there's no real loss. And so therefore, being an Arev on a Ksuva is not financially committing the cosigner. It is a, he's trying to help two people out. Okay. Amar Rav Huna. Okay, Adkan, that takes us not to the end of Arev, there's still more coming up, but we are now continuing in the Gemara. We are towards the bottom of Kuf Ayin Dalet Amud Beis, and a continuation now of more discussions regarding regarding finances of a person. So a person consecrated all of his possessions, and after doing that, he then says, oh, wait one second. Oh, I forgot. $100 needs to go to so-and-so. So Naaman, so a person is believed. Now remember, he's dying right now, so we are assuming that everything he's saying is serious, and the fact that he was makdish everything, and he forgot about this detail, we assume is that that's just simply human forgetting. Meaning, it was a simple mistake. We generally speaking, we assume that person's not going to be playing around with hektish money, and that he is legitimately serious about the fact that he really did owe somebody money. So the Gemara says, well, let's consider the following case, and that is Rav Shmuel both say Shchemir Rosh Amar Manal Laplon Biadi Amar Tenu Nosim Lo Amar Tenu Ain Nosim. If a person while dying says, you know, a lot of my money, I know he says just the money, but okay, I'll leave it as a lot of money. A lot of my money belongs to so and so, but that's all he says. He doesn't give instructions that he should give it to that person or he just simply says a lot of my money belongs to so and so, and then he dies. Can that person now collect the money? So Rav Shmuel says, well, it really depends. If before he died he said the word tenu, so then you give it. If before he died he did not say the word tenu, so then you don't give it. To which the Gemara says, how does that make sense? Meaning, if he admits that he owes so-and-so money, even though he didn't give the instruction of tenu, why wouldn't we be giving him the money? The Gemara says over here, we have an argument that we can make. It's an interesting argument. Ama Adam Asur Shalom. Sorry, let me read that better. Ama Adam Asur Shalola Hasbia es Banav. Hachanami Adam Asur Shalola Hasbia es Atzma. So the Gemara says like this. Here's the argument. The argument is that some people would like to make themselves not look wealthy. The reason why is, you know, modesty, avoiding the Ayin Hara. So in other words, when a person is dying, so people think to themselves, oh my gosh, that's a wealthy man and he's dying and now that's a big estate that's being passed over to his kids, and then the kids get, you know, mobbed with requests, right? Baruch Hashem, I know somebody who father died and, you know, left an estate and just, you know, got phone calls from a lot of people because they know that he just came into a lot of money. So the Gemara says it's expected that what sometimes people do is that people will basically try to Give the impression that they're not that wealthy. So when the person's dying, he's like, oh, I have all this money, but really this money belongs to him, and this money belongs to him. And we can make the argument. In fact, we are making the argument that's really it's not true what he's saying. He just doesn't want to give anybody the impression that he's really wealthy, and that when he dies, his children are going to be really wealthy. So therefore, if he says the words tenu, so then you give it. But if you don't say the word tenu, so then this argument of people want to tone down their wealth and give the impression that wealthy, that's a really compelling argument. So the Gemara says, so can't we say the same thing regarding Hekdesh as well? So the Gemara says, no. The Gemara says no. In the previous case regarding the Hekdesh, he was actually holding the note, meaning the person who was owed the money. So since the person was actually holding the note, so now we have to take the person seriously. So the Gemara says, so Amar Tenu Nosnei Mava Pehava. So the Gemara says, well, wait 1 second. So you're telling me that in the case of the Rav and Shmuel, there was no note. Well, if there was no note, so now what are we talking about? We're talking about an oral obligation. So the Gemara says, Rav Shmuel Damer Tavai Milva Peino Gova Lomene Yoshim Lomene Lekuchos. Gemara says, let's remind each other that both according to Rav and Shmuel, when collecting from when dealing with an oral obligation, you don't collect from the estate. You don't collect from people who buy the property. Meaning the only person you can go after when it comes to an oral obligation is only the principal borrower, and that's it. So the Gemara says, Elam Rav Nachman Idi Nakashtari. So it must be then both of these cases there's a note being held against the person who was dying. So the Gemara says, and the difference must be that in one case the shtar was a shtar mekuyam, but it was a certified document, therefore collectible, and in the other case it was not a certified document and therefore not collectible. Amar tenu kaima lishtare, lo amar tenu lo kaima lishtare. And so therefore, if it was a certified document, so then we're good, we're done. But if it was an uncertified document, now we need his oral instruction. Meaning, if he says, I owe so-and-so money, and then he said, with follow up with the instruction of tenu, so then the word tenu is basically certification of the document. And now when the document holder, when the note holder is going after the kids, he's holding now a certified note in order for so that he can get paid. Amar Rabba. Shrimira
Shah.
So without the word tenu, without the word tenu, there's no instruction. In other words, an observation by itself is not enough. Just because he says, I know it sounds strange, but this is what we're learning. Just because he says, hey, I owe so-and-so money, that doesn't mean that the instructions are to pay. Instructions are, give him money. He has to be very clear on the instruction.
And if that so-and-so was there while he said it, can he collect this one?
It doesn't. I don't know. Meaning the word tenu is what we're learning together is that you have to say tenu. He has to instruct. Amar Rav Shchimira Shamar Manal Aponi Biadiva Amar Yisom in Parani. A Shchimira says that the Shchimira says that a money of so and so is in my hand, and then the Yisomim say, yeah, but we paid it back now, manim. Tenu manel aponi v'am Yisomim paranu. If, however, he instructs and says, give so and so money, and the kids said, we paid it back, ain't that manim. So the Gemara says, then the kids do not believe. The Gemara says, kap alai, yibchem mistabr. Wait 1 second. The way this halacha was just given to us, it seems just the opposite. Amr tenu mane. So the Gemara says, if his instructions were give, kevin de paske avon, lemilse, ikam emet de pare. So the Gemara says, once the father gave very clear instructions, so then the argument could be that once he gave the instructions, so then it was paid. Kevin Depari, Manalaponi Biadi, but with just the passive line of, oh, so and so's money is in my hand, Kevin Delopasikavon Lamilsa, since he did not give clear instruction, Ikalamema Delopare. So now one can make the argument that he didn't pay. Eli Idmar Hachi Idmar. So the Gemara says, so upon further consideration, we're going to say now just the other way around. Shchimera Shamar Manalaponi Biadi, Vamin Yosam, and Chazava Amar Lanu Abba Parati. Where the Shchimera says that the money of so-and-so is in my hand. And the Yisamim say that our father told us that it was paid, ne'amanim. The kids are believed. My taima, atkuri mitkar. Because over there, it could just simply be that they helped Dad refresh his memory. However, tenu manaleploni varm yisomim chaz v'am arba parati. However, if Dad said as part of his chimera instructions, give so and so money, and then at a later point in time the kids say, "Oh, you know what? I know Dad said that. We admit Dad said that, but at a later point in time he said, "Oh no, you know what? Forget it." So the Gemara says, Yisom Chaz V'Amar Abba Parati, Ein Amanim, Deim Isa Dapari Lo Hav Amar Tenu. Because the Gemara says that if that instructs to give, the fault assumption, of course, is that it was so far unpaid, and now this is a clear representation of the idea that it needs to be paid. And finally, before we get to the next Mishnah, by Rav Shchemira Shahoda Ma'u Tzarech Lamar Atem Edai, Oein Tzarech Lamar Atem Edai. When Dad is about to make an admission as a Shchemira, saying as to whether or not he owes so-and-so money, and the instruction to pay so-and-so, does he have to specify witnesses there, or is enough that there are witnesses over there, even though he doesn't specify and designate the witnesses? The Gemara wants to know, the Gemara further explains this question. When he's speaking, does he have to now basically tell people, hey, record this down, because what I'm saying is really important, or is it self-understood? Is it self-evident? So the Gemara says, "Oein tzarich lamar ksuva." Adam mishata b'shas misa, oein adam mishata b'shas misa. And the Gemara's question is, and it seems like we already know the answer. The Gemara's going to give a very clear answer. The Gemara's question is that when a person's dying, is he prone to make jokes? In other words, is that a good time for humor? So, morbid humor, certainly, but, you know, are people at all going to, you know, like make a joke, hey, you know, I owe him $1 million. So the Gemara says, the Gemara says, Basa debaya hada pashte, ein ad meshat b'shas misa v'divrei shchimera, kiksuvim uchemesurim dami. To which the Gemara finally concludes and says that, you know, when a person is dying, a person is not prone to make jokes. Everything he's saying is serious. He doesn't have to designate witnesses. He doesn't need to instruct anybody to go ahead and to record everything that he's saying. The context of the situation clearly indicates that everything he's saying is absolute. And if he's going to give any instructions, all the instructions need to be followed verbatim. Okay, we'll stop over here. We'll pause over here. Tomorrow we have an amud tomorrow. So we'll make up our ground tomorrow. Tomorrow we finish Baba Basra, unbelievably. And on Tuesday already. Wow. Tuesday we start Sanhedrin. Okay, just a quick recap of today. We finished our discussion today about the relationship of the guarantor to the borrower, the relationship of the guarantor to the estate, various cases where the guarantor paid the loan expecting reimbursement from the estate. Okay, that was a slightly complicated discussion. The story of the day, which was yesterday's daf, was regarding Rav Huna, the son of Moshe Bar Tzari, who got married but falling on hard times. Abaye made the suggestion, hey, divorce your wife, let her collect the ksuv and then remarry her. Didn't work out. It was a halachic issue. There were also ethical, moral conundrums. The Gemara dealt with all that. And then a discussion in the Gemara of when a person at his deathbed makes an admission that he owes somebody money without giving the instruction to know. So it could very well be that he's just simply downplaying the money that he has. And the Gemara says, and that in fact is really a compelling argument and a mitigating condition that one has to consider. If he says the words to know, that's instruction to give. But without saying the word to know, one could make the argument, the Gemara does in fact, that he really doesn't owe the money and he's just downplaying his wealth.